So we are up to the moment of conscience. And although, as we'll see, I think it's fair to say that Hegel does to conscience what he does to everything else, namely pairs of pieces, it is equally the last position within spirit, and that therefore, at least as I read Hegel, and this is not accepted by all readers of Hegel, but as I read Hegel, I take it that under redescription, so under a Hegelian redescription, I think he thinks that we all are conscientious selves. So that the notion of conscience, and therefore it ends surprising, for example, that radical theorists like Nietzsche and Heidegger should actually be philosophers of conscience. That the notion of conscience looks like it's what's left of the possibility of modern moral subjectivity, although Hegel is going to set a certain set of problems for it, and therefore require a certain type of redescription of it. The second thing he said about this section is that although the notion of conscience itself is probably, but who knows, probably belongs to Fichte, it might belong to Jacobi, and then there are all his accounts of beautiful souls, and the picture of the beautiful soul can just refer to just about any moral philosopher who wrote between 1796 and 1806. Whether it's Hölderlin or Novalis or the Schlegels, I mean, it's just really hard to know, and it seems to me all the guesses are just that. I'm never persuaded by all of the textual research. The third thing to say is, just in a preparatory way, first, I've already mentioned that the phenomenology has, I suggested, not only many beginnings, but three endings. This is the first of the endings. Evil and forgiveness are the end of the chapter on spirit, and that's the end of the book we've been reading since the beginning of the semester in a certain way, and religion starts a different train of thought altogether, and I'll explain why it is. So that there are some people who believe, but it's erroneous, that the phenomenology is a series of ascents, where religion really does come after spirit. But I don't read the book that way. I read religion as a new beginning of a certain kind, for reasons we'll come to. And then chapter on absolute knowing. And, the final thought is, what we're going to be picking up today is what we discussed at the very beginning of this semester, namely the problem of why action requires retrospection. That whole series of arguments I gave at the very beginning of the semester is really at the heart of what Hegel is going to have to say about conscience, and what I'm calling the analytic of action is a way of spelling out the limits of intentional action. Okay. So the fundamental problem that caused all the problems of dissemblance and duplicity in the Kant's moral philosophy were that it remained emphatically dualistic. That is, it remained divided between phenomena and noumena, But also, as we saw, it kept positing an end, the truth of morality, which it took to be an infinite task that could never be reached. So it said, you know, that the end of my goal is X, but I'm not allowed to ever reach X, because then morality would disappear, and there'd be no morality, so I've got to be removed from the very thing that I'm seeking after. And what Hegel offers is a series of diagnoses of that difficulty. And the diagnoses ultimately was that gap. Ultimately, it's another problem of realism. And the ultimate structure of realism in Kant is the realism between Wille and Willkür. Willkür is the actual will, and Wille is the rational will, which is the moral law itself. And Hegel thinks here, as he thought when we read The Spirit of Christianity and Its Fate, that this is just putting your God inside you, but still making yourself a slave to that internal God. So that argument that he registers, that Kantianism is an introjection of the Jewish God, is still what he's arguing about here. And therefore, it's quite natural to say that if all the problems derive from that dualism, right, where Wille becomes the highest good as its fullest constructive object, if everything's caused by the dualism, then the only way to get rid of it, and this is what conscience does, is to claim that when one acts conscientiously, one acts on the basis of what one immediately takes to be one's duty. It's still one's duty we're talking about, not what one desires or one feels like, but rather conscience is that inner conviction that I must do this, that this is the one thing I must do, or not be myself. I would destroy myself. I would be nothing if I did not stand up here and be counted, if I did not act. So when you act on your conscience, you identify yourself, who you are, immediately with what you take to be your duty. And therefore, what you actually do, you take to be your duty in the full moral sense of that word. Think of it this way. What we're doing is getting rid of Wille. Now, when he discusses Kant's cap of choice, Henry Allison argues that Kant's required to operate with what he calls the incorporation thesis. And the incorporation thesis is the moral equivalent of the I think that must accompany all my representations. So instead of saying the I think must accompany all my representations, the incorporation states something like I take X, to be the reason for my action means that nothing can count as
as a reason for action unless I do so take it.
So we might call the incorporation an account of moral apperception. Now, this is just perfectly Kantian. This is the thematics of modern subjectivity. And the reason why this must be right is anything that would not involve the incorporation thesis would be a form of realism, would be a form of moral Platonism. That's the argument. So the thought is something like, so this is the biggest version of the critique of the given. Right? So what makes something a reason for me? That it has a certain form? That's Platonism. That it has a certain logic? That's Platonism. That it comes from God? Now that's theology. Okay. The thought is, what gives a reason its character as being a reason for me is that I so take it. Otherwise, it's a law which I have to, as it were, achieve and is utterly beyond me. So the incorporation thesis states that. So you might say, well, surely there's got to be some sort of criterion, at least, for what counts as a good reason for moral action. And the same problem's going to arise. Right? If the criterion is it be universalizable, then something will, not only count as a reason, if I make it the reason of my action. So this is the thought. Another version of this thought is something is legislative only if I self-legislate it. That if human beings truly are autonomous, right? We give ourselves the law, then there can't be a law above us. But if there's no law above us, then the act of incorporation is that by virtue of which something becomes a law. Because only at that moment do all the paraphernalia of universality or normativity or ends in themselves, can they kick in? They can't have any bite prior to being put through the sieve of moral apperception. So we might say that conscience is a totally unconditioned view of moral apperception. That conscience is the view that the taking of something to be your duty is what makes it your duty. So that I determine myself as a moral self by acting on what I understand my duty to be, and anything else amounts to authoritarian. So this is a real... Now, I want to be clear. The taking is a taking of something to be your duty. Right? What you must do. So this is the attempt to provide an absolute synthesis of particular and universal. To make universality and particularity hibernate in that moment of conscientious awareness. So
Again, I am taking what I understand to be the innermost moment of my understanding of myself as a moral being and claiming for it emphatic objectivity. So again, the idea is to utterly collapse, to bring together in one tense moment subjectivity and objectivity. Now, it's important to say that the formation of the conscientious self, Hegel regards as a massive kind of historical achievement. And having been through the various steps along the way, having been through all the versions of exteriority, we can get some glimmer of what that achievement involves. Furthermore, and he doesn't discuss it here, after all, this is the successor position to the French Revolution and to Kant. Which is to say, he is taking for granted that the formation of the conscientious self is the formation of the kind of self for whom, let's call it the ideas, the moral ideas of radical of rational modernity are intrinsic. That is, he is taking it for granted that the conscientious self takes itself to be free, self-determining, and bound by the requirements of universality, in which all human beings are possessed of intrinsic moral dignity. Those views are not the issue. Those are the historical accomplishment of where we are. The question is, how do we inhabit those moral views, those moral ideas? What do we do with them? How do we act on them? Now, the next thought, I guess this should be somewhat surprising, but seems to me right, it is that the very idea of conscience is a philosophical sublation of philosophy. What I mean by that is if this becomes clear in Hegel's account, that after all, what philosophy was some version of a priori legislation. Philosophy was discovering those ultimate laws which told people what they ought to do. And the argument here is, the notion of conscience shows that no one can tell anyone what they ought to do. That what you ought to do is a matter of conscience. And therefore, if you want to know what to do, you consult your conscience, not a philosophy textbook. That only if there was a unique object, a moral universal, which philosophy alone had some privileged insight into, or philosophy could at least display in a way that has not been displayed before, could philosophy have, as it were, control over the moral? But the argument of conscience is, and after all, this is what Kant really thought, right? Kant thought that morality should not be a matter of specialized knowledge. Because if morality were a matter of specialized knowledge, then he would not be able to understand how his servant could be a moral being. Since after reading Rousseau's Émile, it was obvious to him that naive human beings on the street, not just university professors, know something about morality, then the notion of conscience is an inheritor of the idea that morality is not a special compartment of rarefied knowledge, but a possession of the human being as such. For those people who are defending conscience, like Fichte, they're going to try to demonstrate how that can be the case. For Hegel, of course, it's the case because of history. It's history that's formed us into conscientious beings, although the philosophers of conscience don't know that. And insofar as we are philosophers of the conscience, we don't know that, but we're learning it right here. Put the thought another way, if ethicality or morality has an ineliminable moment of negativity, the moment of the negative, that is, nothing is given to me unless I take it as given, so that the notion of there's always, I have to put myself in relationship to whatever I inherit. Therefore, so I'm taking it that the I take is the act of the negative itself. I'm denying the thing in its immediate givenness and saying it has its authority not because it has the content it does alone, but because I take it as my law, and therefore I legislate it for myself. To say all that is equally going to say that morality is necessarily productive and creative, that it exceeds philosophical comprehension precisely because it is an open-ended social practice. This is the ultimate version of the right of subjectivity. Negativity is the difference between identity and difference. Negation is the minimum necessary for the possibility of a reflective relation to oneself. And conscience is the attempt to assert this in the moral sphere.
That's the crude idea. And again, it seems to be obvious that this is not that far from Nietzsche on Eternal Return or Heidegger acting authentically. I mean, these are variations. All these are can say that somehow what is the ultimate source for the authority of my actions cannot be imposed from without, but must be self-imposed. When Robert Bernasconi and I were colleagues, we used to have a routine argument. And the routine argument would go something like, he would say to me, "So exactly what is it you genuflect in front of?" "Other people." "But you can't do that unless there's some authority." I said, "If there's an authority, then I can't genuflect in front of them. So,
argument runs. That he used the term genuflection, I always thought interesting. Watch those Levinasians. They're desperate to bend a knee. Now, we know from the get-go, from the very get-go, we know that the notion of conscience does not work. And the reason we know it does not work is because what you take to be your conscience is different from what I take to be my conscience, and therefore we end up immediately in a conflict of what truly is objective. So the notion of conscience somehow falls apart because somehow the notion of objectivity that it is claiming for itself feels overstretched. And of course there are wonderful accounts of this. There's a wonderful novel by a man named Hobb called Confessions of a Justified Sinner. I wouldn't be surprised if what happened in Blacksburg over the weekend was not a matter of conscience. That is, of someone taking the voice in them to be saying they must cleanse the world, that they have a moral duty to eliminate from the world the unclean. And Hogg's novel really works out this thought powerfully and scarily. So the notion of conscience is like the idea of a moral cogito, right? But somehow, because it wants to claim that it's in possession of what I really should do in the world, that question of objectivity is clearly not satisfactory. Now the question is, I want you to feel at least some of the stress of the moment. If up until 90 seconds ago you were thinking the notion of conscience is just the one you would want to assert, right? And now you're thinking, that's right, of course it's wrong. You should feel stricken and conflicted here. So the question is exactly why it's wrong and exactly what more is going to be needed if the notion of conscience is something we nonetheless want to salvage, because if we don't salvage it, we might as well go straight back to absolute positivity. Might as well just have the old God and skip anything else. Okay, so it helps if we break down the claims of conscience into a series of particular claims. And then what I'm calling the analytic of action will be the way in which I unseat those claims. So first, the first thesis is what I'm calling moral apperception, namely nothing can be my duty unless I take it to be my duty. And this is stated in paragraph 635. Suppose a case of moral action. It is an objective reality for knowing consciousness. This qua conscience knows it in immediate concrete matter, and at the same time it is only as conscience knows it. Second, Hegel claims in paragraph 636 that there is no independent criterion of duty. because any criterion would have to conform to my I take. Third, that in acting, I am exhaustively performing my duty. That is, there, if for a conscientious self, if I take saying no here and now to be my duty, and I say no, that's the end of the matter. I've done my duty. Which is to say there's no form-content distinction, right? The problem with Kant, because of the inner-outer problem, is you never know if you've really done your duty. Here we know. No, this is my duty and I did it. So performance exalts what's required. Fourth, if there is no form-content distinction at the level of action, then my essence, who I truly am, just is my existence. That is, I'm acting, if my doing is the performance of what I take to be my essential self, then in acting I am undergoing an existential self-making. So in a certain sense, right, conscience is a neo-existentialist position. That is, it so unites essence and existence that, and that Vilcur the I take really gives the existential moment a certain priority. And this goes right back, I mean, you should be aware that this goes right back to medieval theology, where there are really two different accounts of God. One, the mystic tradition, in which God is all-knowing because he immediately sees the truth. So, in the Thomistic tradition, there is a kind of Platonism in the sense that God and the truth are united by a kind of absolutism of vision. But there is, even in medieval theology, say in Scotus, a view that God knows the truth because he makes the truth, right? That what makes 2 plus 2 equals 4 is God saying 2 plus 2 equals 4, in which case the incorporation thesis operates for God as well. There are no independent universals. So this moment is actually a certain realization of late medieval nominalism, right, where you're interjecting a God, all right, but a particular kind of God, namely the God of late nominalism. Hegel puts it this way, paragraph 638. Consequently, this self constitutes the content of what was previously the empty essence. For it is actual, a self which no longer has the significance of being a nature alien to the essence and with laws of its own, independent of it. Fifth, it follows from this that I do not exist for the sake of the law, rather the law exists for the sake of the self, which is Nietzsche's version of self-legislation, right? The whole point of self-legislation for Nietzsche, or for the Romantics, if they both had different views, is more freedom, more self, more life, whatever. The more is the laws are not there for me to conform to, but to somehow further the self. Duty, Hegel says, in paragraph 639, is not the universal that stands over against the self, On the contrary, it is known to have no validity when thus separated. It is now the law that exists for the sake of the self, not the self that exists for the sake of the law. And at the beginning, the kind of second sentence of 639, the first sentence of 639 indicates the collapse. If existence and essence are united, then so are particular and universal, right? Further, the self, while pure self-identical knowing, is the absolute universal. Nice feeling to be the absolute universal yourself. Good day. Some little German town somewhere.
Okay.
Well, they all lived in Jena, right? Hung around. So that just this knowing as its own, knowing as conviction, is duty. Seventh, then, if I am the absolute universal, one of those high moments of moral narcissism, then, of course, I take it that what is universal for me is universal for you as well. That is, it can't have any weight unless I take it as really not just for me, but for another as well. So the for itself and the for another are firmly merged. Which is to say that the weight of universality and objectivity is that they are here folded into some notion of intersubjectivity without collapsing into mere intersubjectivity. So in the middle of paragraph 640, Hegel says, the action is thus only the translation of its individual content into the objective element in which it is universal and recognized. And it is just the fact that it is recognized that makes the deed a reality. The deed is recognized and thereby made real because the existent reality is directly linked with conviction or knowledge. Or in other words, knowing one's purpose is directly the element of existence, is universal recognition. Think of it this way. You could not claim that the action was immediately, the doing of it was immediately the accomplishment of duty, unless that exteriority was not just for yourself, but for the other as well. So it entails, it demands that the other recognize it as you recognize it. Otherwise, that claim to objectivity is compromised. Okay. Now, it's in unpacking these moments that we begin to unpack what the problems of conscience are. But in unpacking what the problems of conscience are, we're not getting rid of conscience. We are reforming it into a different shape. So I want to suggest. And I could be wrong. I think Hegel's
critique of conscience boils down to four theses, which I call his analytic of action. The first issue is the question of moral knowledge. And the question here is, or the way Hegel gets at the problem, is not to say, ooh, you know, my duty is X or Y. I mean, what's at stake here is concrete actions, not some moral principle. What's at stake here is what actually is going to count as satisfying whatever those principles are. So, aiding someone in distress. Right? So the question of moral knowledge is not whether I have awareness of moral principles, it's whether I have sufficient awareness of the situation in which I am acting. So if you are a moral agent, then your action is dependent upon the relevant moral conditions and features of the situation in which you are acting. Now, because a situation is always this situation, that's the easy. And to be this situation, it has to be here. But if it's here, then it's conditioned spatially, right, by all the things surrounding it. And if it's now, then it's conditioned by a complex history stretching way out into the past, then in claiming that what you are doing is the right thing, you are claiming that you have sufficient knowledge of the situation. So the way in which moral conscience deals with this question is, it says, of course I know that I do not have complete moral knowledge of all the temporal conditions, all the spatial conditions, plus, you know, say I'm aiding you in distress. I have to know, is this person in distress? In distress because they're trying to murder their neighbor and they've broken their finger, if I bandage their finger, you know. So you also have to know their intentions. You're not going to murder your neighbor. But I don't know. I don't know, right? So I have to know, to act appropriately, I have to know all the relevant factors. Now, conscience, in order to deal with this, simply says, I'm going to count as sufficient knowledge what I take to be sufficient knowledge of the situation, right? And therefore ignore or not let bother me all those troubling features. But by saying that, it's acknowledging that it does not know. And therefore, in truth, its moral knowledge must be fallible. But if its moral knowledge is fallible, then equally its action must be fallible, because it's what it's supposed to do is based on its knowledge. Hence, conscience, in part, runs into difficulty
because it is necessarily provincial, which is to say stricken with contingency, and the trick of conscience is to try to turn contingency into non-contingency, and that it cannot do without essentially becoming another form of subjectivism. Because once it denies, right, that there is a question of knowledge, you know, once it acknowledges there is a question of knowledge, then it has to acknowledge that its knowledge better be true or its actions won't work. The notion of conscience can't, as it were, override the contingency and the conditionality of its own knowing, which is to say, the only unconditioned feature of human knowing is its necessary conditionality. Q? To put it another way, moral reality is intrinsically complex, and that complexity cannot be overridden. Further, acting itself changes the situation beyond how you can imagine it. That thought, that acting alters a situation beyond how you originally conceived it, leads to the second thesis, what I call the reproachability thesis. Surely, the argument runs from conscience's point of view, if I reflect well and I am acting on what I take to be the best possible motives, then you might say what I have done is beyond moral reproach. So part of the notion of conscience is that when I act conscientiously, I mean my action to be beyond moral reproach, for I have done what I exhaustively take to be my duty. And that is part of a secret stoicism running throughout all this, right? I want to insulate my moral standing from the contingencies, again, of the world. So this is another version. The idea of beyond moral reproach is also the idea of what I call clean hands morality. That if I do what I take to be the absolutely right and correct moral thing, all things being equal, then no matter what happens, I'm morally okay. My hands are morally clean. Now, to think this, and this is really consistent with the Kantian moral vision, where intentions are what you judge, is necessarily to say that in judging an action, consequences do not matter. So this is really the radical, this is the way conscience, despite its claim to existentialism and to actuality, radically separates moral intention from moral consequence. But Hegel wants to say that consequences do matter, and because consequences do matter, that no intention is beyond reproach. So the example I give, the kind of easy macro example, is at a certain moment, the United Nations, no more morally conscientious group, bringing humanitarian aid into Bosnia. Humanitarian aid sounds great. What, of course, we know happened is they made things easier for the Serbian genocide.
So they constantly intended humanitarian aid. What they accomplished was an aiding of a genocidal project. And that means we have to judge their action accordingly. It wasn't just morally okay or good. In fact, it was morally disastrous.
Morally disastrous not because of what they intended, but because of what happened.
And this is to say that we cannot judge fully the meaning of an action until we fully understand what the consequences of doing it are,
which is to say the meaning of an action, its sense, its moral sense, runs through time. It's equally to say that chance is not external to ethics. Good Aristotelian thesis, thesis of moral luck. And further, and here there is an issue about moral desire and inclination. And this bit of the argument runs like this. The nature of conscientious action is not a matter of abstract willing. Rather, the idea is that our fundamental moral orientation in the world is affective and libidinal. So, of course, again, remember the Kantian picture is inclination struggling with the superego, telling it, you know, don't do that. The notion of conscience is attractive because conscience says, no, no, no. The question is, what are my truest, deepest, most abiding inclinations, desire, and emotions? So what conviction does, the idea of conviction, is replace Kantian acting from duty rather than from inclination to acting from my deepest and most abiding desires and inclinations. The thought here is that the conscientious self does not want to exclude natural desires from a role in our moral relationships. If I think that what is most important to me are the lives of my children, then the notion of conscience, as it were, happily tolerates the thought that doing what is necessary to protect them is indeed acting on what I take to be most important, but that it is not thereby compromised because there is that natural source. However, even if I cannot imagine acting otherwise, it does not follow that what I do is beyond reproach. That is, I may be acting on what I think is most important, protecting my children. Maybe perfectly comprehensible. But maybe the cost of that was many thousands of people dying. And you want to say, of course I understand that, you know, you being the father, blah, blah, blah. You're not going to sacrifice your children. How could you? Nonetheless, by making that choice, you could have prevented hundreds of thousands of deaths, and you did not. But action is not beyond which is to say, this is what I mean by no clean hands. I'm not exactly saying that the person should have done otherwise, although I am saying that it might have been, all things being equal, morally the right thing. A And when I did this earlier, just to remind you, I just mentioned to you that, therefore, the notion of reproachability, what I'm calling reproachability here, is part of what I argue is the fabric of human action. It's why we have the categories of remorse and regret. So to say that conscience trumps is, again, to deny the possibility of reproachability and therefore to deny the possibility of remorse, regret, and all the other backward-looking emotions. This is why I take Nietzsche to be such a consistent philosopher of conscience, right? Because that's what just what he does, right? He says all that is just your revenge against time. To put it another way, all human action is risky, and nothing can insulate us from that riskiness. Interpretive pluralism. This is another subtopic in reproachability. Hegel contemplates that the reason why these problems of reproachability occur is because of the over immediacy of the identification of self and morality. But if you have that, in order for that collapse to occur, the truth of the matter is, as I suggested before, the self, or Willkür, really has to be beyond any content. That is, it, by being self-legislation, it determines content. But if it determines the content all by itself, this is what all theories of self-legislation believe, then it, in a sense, decides on the content. And if it decides on the content, then there can be paragraph 646 of the body. Hegel is here thinking about the Schlegels, I have no doubt. He's thinking about romantic irony. He's thinking about the idea of the self as it were, being nothing but a continuous self-making. It's another version of this, self-fashioning. And everywhere in Hegel, romantic irony is a worry for him because it is the avant-garde of the theory of freedom. So at the very end of the paragraph, he says, but even so, conscience is free from any content whatever. It absolves itself from any specific duty which is supposed to have the validity of law. In the strength of its own self-assurance, it possesses the majesty of absolute autarky to bind and to loose. The thought is, if something becomes a law by being self-legislated, that is, by self-binding, well, then whatever I bound myself to, I can unbind. That is, something about the notion of self-binding as the crucial moment, as it were, loses how things' content is to weigh. So that if there's no content, independent of the binding of myself to it, right?
I am free of that content because, again, whatever I decide to self-find, I can just as easily get rid of. Think of what happened in Zarathustra, where Zarathustra said, at some point I simply grow tired of my own creations, and I need to create anew. So the idea here is all these things that Zarathustra has created are there in order to enrich Zarathustra as a self-making, self-fashioning subject. But that means even for him, they have no ultimate content because they're merely in the service of what Hegel's calling autarky. Call it freedom, call it life, call it whatever you want to call it. It means the self is beyond. Let's stop there. Let's have a thought. Let's have a break. I've been shouting for an hour. Just a quick break. And then we'll see how all this continues to unwind.